State. Once again, no morning show today. We're going to carry the next hour of Morning Edition as this election is still hanging in the balance this morning.
Covers voting noted that there's something well north of 2 million, I think she said 2.5 million or so, mail-in ballots in Pennsylvania alone. That is a state the president is leading. That is a state the president could really use and would take him a long way toward 270, but that he cannot claim yet. Michigan is in this similar category. There are a couple of other states that are leaning toward Biden, such as Wisconsin at this moment, and Nevada. And Wisconsin has gone from tinted red to tinted blue just in the last couple of hours. Now, in the midst of all this, there were these statements by the presidential candidates, and let's hear the president first. He spoke in the early hours this morning. He had previously said he would not try to stampede a victory. He would not prematurely claim victory, and then he falsely claimed victory. Let's listen.
I want to thank the American people for their tremendous support. Millions and millions of people voted for us tonight, and a very sad group of people is trying to disenfranchise that group of people, and we won't stand for it.
The president has been talking about mail-in ballots, which have been used safely for years as a source of fraud. He's been doing that for months without any evidence, falsely. Franco, did he present any evidence of fraud last night?
No, he has not. I mean, you just made the case that he's been kind of laying the groundwork since the spring and the summer against mail-in voting, you know, saying that votes shouldn't be counted after Election Day. In a way, he's, you know, carrying out threats that he made over the weekend, which was to go in with his lawyers. But, you know, he was pressed on this actually yesterday morning by one of his favorite programs, Fox and Friends, and he clearly backed off that threat, saying that a victor will only be called when there is a victory, and so there's no reason to play games. So this is, you know, really a stunning reversal, considering there is no victory. There is still a lot to be counted.
And more things were unusual here. This was effectively a campaign event. He chose to hold it on federal property inside the White House. There is a Hatch Act which forbids federal employees from using federal facilities or using their federal time for political activity. He went ahead and held the event there. He's not specifically covered by the Hatch Act, though others are. And while in this setting of doubtful legality, the president made allegations of illegality in the election. Let's listen to a little more.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
And he said he would take that false claim to the Supreme Court. Did he say what the grounds would be for a lawsuit, though?
No, he has not. And those, you know, claims are largely unfounded. No news organization has declared a victor. You know, we have said over and over again, there are millions of mail-in ballots to be counted. A lot of that has to do because state and local Republican officials had insisted that they not be counted until Election Day. And look, the Supreme Court on Monday, we're talking about Pennsylvania, ruled to allow count mail-in ballots in Pennsylvania that were postmarked by Election Day. So there's a lot to go here.
Okay, and we don't know where court fights are going, but there's another candidate, and we'll check in with the other candidate now. NPR's Scott Detrow has been covering the Biden campaign, and he joins us from Wilmington, Delaware, right, Scott?
That's right. Joe Biden spoke last night around 12:45 before the president spoke, but he clearly anticipated this attempt to undermine legitimate vote counting from President Trump. Let's listen to what Biden had to say last night as votes were coming in.
As I've said all along, it's not my place or Donald Trump's place to declare who's won this election. That's the decision of the American people. But I'm optimistic about this outcome.
We hear the horns honking, I guess, because it was one of those car rallies where everybody's in their cars. Is that right, Scott?
That's right. Biden, when he speaks in front of a big crowd, they do drive-in rallies so that people can safely distance. And since we've heard from Biden, he has pulled ahead in Wisconsin after Milwaukee posted its early vote totals. And as you were saying, more than a million uncounted early votes in Pennsylvania, a lot of votes to count in Michigan and Georgia, too. And we're seeing Trump's Michigan lead narrow this morning.
Okay, so let's talk through the map a little bit. I mentioned those six states. You just mentioned a couple of them. Can we see what Biden's path to victory would be, even though on election night he was trailing? I guess it starts with, well, he won Arizona, right? And then there's Nevada. What happens after that?
Arizona is important because this is the first and only state so far that the AP has called that is a flip from 2016. This is a trench warfare situation other than Arizona, and that gives Biden an edge on Trump. And then it's the states we've talked about for years now, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Biden is ahead now in Wisconsin as more and more of those final mail-in ballots come in. The outstanding ballots in Michigan and Pennsylvania will likely be overwhelmingly Democratic, though if Biden does pull ahead, it would likely be by a pretty narrow margin. Biden also spoke last night about their confidence in the early vote totals that still need to be counted.
I'm here to tell you tonight, we believe we're on track to win this election. Yes. We knew because of the unprecedented early vote, the mail-in vote, that it's going to take a while. We're going to have to be patient until the hard work of tallying the votes is finished. And it ain't over till every vote is counted.
And Steve, I'd like to talk about one other state that's getting a little lost here.
Please.
Georgia. It's roughly in the same position as Michigan and Pennsylvania. Trump is narrowly ahead, but there's a significant uncounted vote in and around Atlanta. For all of the conversation about how Democrats fell far short of expectations, this long Republican state is the big exception, and it could be a huge factor. Remember, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Barack Obama all made last-minute in-person pushes there.
And I'm just thinking through when we think about the map and the way it comes together. If Vice President Biden were to win Georgia, he would need one less of those Midwestern states in order to prevail, correct?
That's right. At the moment, I think Biden has a better path than Trump, knowing what we know about the outstanding votes.
Okay. That's NPR's Scott Detrow and NPR's Franco Ordonez with the latest. Thanks very much.
Sure thing.
NPR spoke to a number of voters outside their polling places last night. Here's how Izzy O'Connell from Washington, D.C. was feeling.
I'm just stressed. Yeah, I think just a lot of chronic stress, and a lot of people are going to be confused for a while.
Christopher Wilson in Chicago was planning for a long fight ahead.
If we have to go all the way to the Supreme Court, then I say we go all the way to the Supreme Court. You know, I hope we don't have to go to that. That's a lot of taxpayer dollars just to figure out who's going to be the president. But I feel that we have to do what we have to do in order to maintain this democracy.
Arielle Cohane from New York was literally betting on a Trump win.
I put $900 on President Trump already. It's like a 2-for-1, meaning if Trump wins, I'll get $1,800.
Ben Broughton from Dripping Springs, Texas, was also feeling optimistic about the president's chances.
For every Biden sign, you see 100 Trump signs. So, I just don't see it. If there's enthusiasm on the left, I don't see it. I feel more confident now than I did in 16.
Patrick Bosworth voted in Las Vegas. He said if Trump does win, Biden's loss would be an important wake-up call for the Democratic Party.
You know, assuming they lose it outright in a verifiable way, I think there would be a lot of soul searching that would have to happen around why these voting coalitions aren't working.
Another Vegas voter, Emma Post, told us no matter who wins, she's anticipating it's going to take a lot of work to unite the country.
I just don't think it ends with the election. I think it's this continuous journey that we all have to be committed to long beyond today or next month or next year.
Just a few of the voices from Election Day 2020. This is NPR News.
Good morning. This is Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 19 past 8. Thanks for listening. In 10 minutes, we'll have more election results for you here on WPR. And later this hour, Wisconsin Life. Today, we'll hear about a young entrepreneur in Milwaukee who's keeping her lemonade business going well after the summer and into the school year. Stay tuned.
PBS Wisconsin is proud to offer Bright by Text, a free texting service for parents and caregivers of children ages 8 and younger. Text the word Badger to 274-448 and receive research-based, age-specific resources and activities from trusted content partners like PBS Kids. Get free educational resources delivered to your phone with Bright by Text from PBS Wisconsin. Just text Badger to 274-448.
Support for WPR comes from American Transmission Company, moving energy from where it is generated to communities where it is needed. Committed to reducing environmental impact and promoting recreational trails and wildlife habitat the whole community can appreciate. Support also comes from Jay Handy of Signal Point Asset Management, focusing on financial planning in times of transition, such as retirement, inheritance, or the sale of a business. Signal Point Asset Management, proud to support Wisconsin Public Radio.
An unseasonably warm weather forecast for the state. Sunny skies around Wisconsin today will have highs in the upper 60s to around 70. For Thursday and Friday, continued sunny around Wisconsin with a few clouds in the south. Highs from the 60s to around 70 degrees.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday, committed to delivering quick insights to help finance teams plan for what's next. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. Learn more at workday.com. From iDrive, providing cloud backup, full system backup, and on-site iDrive appliance to protect PCs, Macs, and servers from data loss due to crashes and ransomware. At iDrive.com/NPR. And from Charles Schwab. Charles Schwab Financial Consultants believe in getting to know the people behind the portfolios with personalized advice, tax-smart investing strategies, and retirement planning. More at Schwab.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Let's recap the electoral map as we see it at NPR.org. Neither Donald Trump nor Joe Biden has 270 electoral votes, the number needed to win. Joe Biden has made one significant gain, winning Arizona, a state that Republicans had won for a generation. Donald Trump has overperformed the polls and held on to key states like Florida and Texas. Other states, including Midwest states like Michigan and Wisconsin, remain undecided. So there is so much to discuss here, and we're going to discuss at least some of it with some regular guests, Republican strategist Scott Jennings and Democratic strategist Karen Finney. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Scott, I want to begin with you. Trump did do better than the polls would have suggested in Florida. He seemed to be trailing a bit and instead won rather easily.
Yeah, Florida, like a lot of other states, the rural areas, the election day turnout for Republicans really did materialize for Donald Trump. So a couple of things stick out to me. Number one, it's apparently still very hard for the pollsters to capture the energy for Donald Trump and Republicans in places with significant rural areas. And number two, the Trump campaign's investment in a traditional field program, door knocking, voter registration, et cetera, appears to have really paid off in a number of states, and Florida included.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Democrats held off on the door knocking for a while because of the pandemic. Karen Finney, what do you make of how close this is, how much closer the race is than the polls would have suggested?
Well, two things. One, having gone through 2016, I was always wary of the polls and believed that we would see that surge that Scott was just talking about in Trump voters. We saw it in 2016. There was no reason to think we wouldn't see it again. But the other thing is, look, I think it's close because we're a divided country. Whereas in so many places across the country, we know that Democrats did very well also with voter outreach and registration and voter contact through, you know, non-traditional means like texting and phone banking. So I think you saw, you know, both sides really turned out in pretty strong numbers. And again, I think it shows what a divided country we are.
Really remarkable turnout, and we want to emphasize again, we are analyzing a race whose results are incomplete. Neither candidate has 270 electoral votes. It would appear that millions of votes are uncounted. So that's the backdrop to talk about what the candidates have made of this. As we're hearing elsewhere in the program, Joe Biden made a statement in which he urged patience. He didn't claim he had won, but he said that he thought he was going to win. President Trump made a much more unusual statement in which he made false claims that he believed he had won, and that went through an analysis of the states and so forth, and even said he was taking it to the Supreme Court. What do each of you make of those statements? Karen, you can go first.
Well, it's exactly what he's been telegraphing for months. Not surprising that he wants to get it to the Supreme Court. We know that was, or it certainly was reported that that may have been part of the impetus for installing Amy Coney Barrett so quickly to make sure that there was a Supreme Court that he believed would be in his favor. At the same time, I think, you know, Biden's message was very important. We do need to make sure that every vote is counted in this very unprecedented year. And, you know, it's 2020 and a lot of things have happened in 2020 that we didn't expect. And so I know the Biden team is well prepared to make sure to meet every challenge and make sure every vote is counted. And I think we've got many of the American people behind him on that.
Scott Jennings, what did you think of these statements?
Well, number one, hearing them both made me thankful of the decentralized nature of how we administer elections in this country. I've heard some people over the years argue for a more federalized electoral system. This is exactly why we have a decentralized state and local-based system, so that no one actor, in this case a president or a presidential candidate, can have too much influence over it. And it doesn't really matter what Joe Biden says or what Donald Trump says, because secretaries of state, county clerks, these are the people who ultimately have the responsibility to count the votes. And so, you know, all this talk about the Supreme Court and litigation, I think it's all very premature until we see what the vote counts are. You know, courts can't just step in and say, we decree that this happened. You know, there have to be specific claims and specific issues that that come up before anything like that could occur. So I'm today, this morning, Steve, most thankful for the fact that we have clerks and secretaries of state and not a federal electoral system, because I think it gives me more confidence in the overall system.
You are stating a fact, Scott Jennings, and that is a reason that we can have some confidence in the results. And even if there was a problem in one precinct or one state, it could get controversial, as it did in 2000 in Florida. But most of the country we're going to have confidence in, and maybe all of the country we're going to have confidence in. You also correctly note, we don't know of any legal basis for any court claim that would go to the Supreme Court. Let me ask you, though, Scott Jennings, about what you think the attitude is of congressional leaders. You, of course, have been close to Mitch McConnell. Do you have in your mind a circumstance in which congressional Republicans would stick with the president if he claimed fraud, and a circumstance in which they would say, no, we're not going there?
Well, I think congressional leaders would follow the law and follow any process or procedure that is prescribed by the law. And so if we get into a situation where there's litigation and there's a legal remedy for some matter, I think they would be willing to follow a course as long as it's prescribed by law. I don't think congressional leaders would be willing to go down any rabbit hole that seems to be outside of what would be normally prescribed avenues to cure issues that have come up. And right now, obviously, as you correctly note, there's so much we don't know in so many states that I think they're probably today going to take the posture of, let's get some more votes counted, and then let's talk about what would happen next. But no, I don't think any congressional leader, Steve, is going to go down an extrajudicial or, sort of unknown process here just because the president asked them to. I think they're going to want to follow the law.
Okay. Karen Finney and Scott Jennings, it's always a pleasure talking with you both, and perhaps we'll have a chance to check in with you again. Thank you very much. This is NPR News.
America Has Voted. We'll bring you the latest results in election 2020 and oral arguments at the Supreme Court that pit anti-discrimination laws against religious rights.
I can't foster or adopt through an agency who has a shared belief.
A case that could help redefine religious liberty precedents. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Brady Carlson is your host for All Things Considered, and it starts at 4 here on WPR. It's Morning Edition on WPR. More election results and all the latest news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio up next. And NPR will have a special update on the election tonight at 8. WPR will be carrying that coverage.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. They're still counting the votes in the 2020 presidential election because of all the mail-in ballots. The results in a number of key states in the Midwest and South are still unknown. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports on what President Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden are saying about the results thus far.
Speaking from the White House, President Trump prematurely and falsely declared victory, saying the results of the election have been phenomenal.
The citizens of this country have come out in record numbers. This is a record. There's never been anything like it.
Earlier in the night, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden urged Americans to be patient as millions of mail-in ballots are still being counted.
Until the hard work of tallying the votes is finished, and it ain't over till every vote is counted, every ballot is counted.
Races have not been called in a number of crucial swing states, including Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
Biden later criticized the president for linking the ongoing vote counts to fraud, calling Trump's comments outrageous. 270 electoral votes are needed to win the White House. Right now, Biden has 238, Trump has 213. Democrats have picked up at least two seats in the Senate, one in Arizona and another in Colorado. Republicans gained a Senate seat in Alabama. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. After a night of ballot counting, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden took the lead in Wisconsin with the great majority of the state's votes in. The razor-thin margin was an echo of 2016's tight race. Madeline Fox has more.
Biden took the lead in the state after 3:30 a.m. when the city of Milwaukee finished counting nearly 200,000 ballots. Final absentee ballot counts from the cities of Kenosha and Green Bay after 6 a.m. pushed Biden ahead by just over 20,000 votes. That's out of 3.2 million ballots. As of 7 a.m., results were not official, and the Associated Press had not called the state for either candidate. Biden improved margins in the Democratic strongholds of Dane and Milwaukee counties, but Trump's base turned out too. He replicated his huge margins of victory in many rural areas and, in general, maintained Republican strength in suburban areas. That made for a close result. Prior to the election, polls had shown Biden with a comfortable lead. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin health officials are reporting record numbers of new COVID-19 cases in the state. As Bridget Bowden reports, nearly every county in the state has a very high level of virus activity.
As voters cast their ballots in person yesterday, the State Department of Health Services reported more than 5,700 new cases of COVID-19, the highest the state has seen yet. DHS reported 52 new deaths, including the first in Menominee County. All but two of Wisconsin's counties have a very high level of virus activity. Nearly 250 people were newly hospitalized on Tuesday because of the virus, bringing the total number of people currently hospitalized to 1,714. More than 2,000 Wisconsinites have died. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Republicans will retain control of the Wisconsin State Senate, but won't get a veto-proof supermajority. In the 30th State Senate race to replace retiring longtime Democratic Senator Dave Hansen in the Green Bay area, Republican Eric Wimmer defeated Democrat Jonathan Hansen by eight points. In the 10th State Senate race in northwestern Wisconsin, incumbent Democrat Patty Schachner lost the Senate seat she won in 2018's special election to Republican Representative Rob Staffschult of New Richmond by 20 points. There's more election news available on our website. Go to WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features presenting Let 'Em Go, starring Diane Lane and Kevin Costner as a couple who will risk their lives to save their young grandson from a treacherous family, in theaters Friday. From Doubleday, publisher of A Time for Mercy by John Grisham, who returns to the characters and setting of A Time to Kill in his latest courtroom drama. A Time for Mercy is in stores now. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. When Donald Trump won the presidency in 2016, three states were decisive. Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin had voted for Democrats for president so often they were called the Blue Wall, a wall that collapsed in a sea of red in 2016. This time around, all three are so far undecided as we wait on absentee and mail-in ballots to be counted. Let's check in on two of those states, starting with Michigan, which is where we find NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne. Hey there, Don.
Good morning.
Great match of correspondent with a story here. You've lived in Michigan, grew up in Michigan, covered Michigan so long. Where'd you spend this election night?
I was in downtown Detroit in the old convention center right downtown. It's a place where I can't tell you how many auto shows I've been to and covered for NPR. Mm. But instead of glitzy automobiles, it was just row after row after row after row of nondescript long tables with maybe a half a dozen people at each table going through bins and sorting through those absentee ballots. This is the place where every single absentee ballot in the city of Detroit was counted. Then there are similar places like this, though perhaps not quite as large, in smaller cities where people were doing the exact same thing. Going through those absentee ballots has to be done by hand.
And I guess we have a sense of the scale of the problem in that they seem to have been doing that all night. And while most of the vote appears to have been tabulated in Michigan, not enough of it has been tabulated for us to know.
Right. We're up to 75-80% of the vote in. Obviously, that number is, you know, changing probably as we speak because they have been working all night. But 60% of the vote in this state, and it's a big state, was by absentee ballot. So it's just a much longer process than it normally would be. Early on, the Secretary of State earlier in the week said it would probably be Friday by the time we had a complete result, which doesn't mean that there wouldn't be enough to call the race one way or another before then, but Friday till we had a complete result. Hmm. Now she's saying that it's gone more quickly than they thought, and they may be able to finish by this evening, maybe 9 o'clock or so.
Okay, so we are still, in either case, expecting a number of hours of waiting, and we'll see how things go there. Can you give us some perspective on what's been happening in Michigan? It went for Trump in 2016, then it elected a Democratic governor in 2018. Things have been rather dramatic during pandemic times.
Yeah, and this is one of those states that going back to the beginning of the Bill Clinton era, it had become reliably Democratic in presidential contests every year until 2016. I talked to a lot of voters yesterday, mostly around the Detroit area, and Trump himself was a big issue and a big motivating factor for people to go out. And of course, in the Detroit area, that was a vote against Donald Trump. But a lot of people mentioned the coronavirus. You know, the auto industry has been hit hard by this economic impact of coronavirus. So it is a place where it was not hard to find people looking for change, but we just don't know which way this is going to go yet.
Okay, Don, thank you very much for the reporting.
My pleasure.
NPR's Don Gagne. And again, the big picture, the bottom line, neither candidate has 270 electoral votes. Some of those still at issue are in Michigan. And we just heard from Don that it may be 9 o'clock this evening before absentee ballots are counted. We could have a result before then. We may not. However it goes, we will give you the facts that we know.
Another very pivotal state right now, Pennsylvania. And that's where we are joined by NPR's Jeff Brady, who is in Philadelphia. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Rachel.
So, like a lot of other states, Pennsylvania was just flooded with a lot of mail-in ballots. And presumably, that's why it's taken so long. What can you tell us?
Yeah, last year, Pennsylvania's legislature made it much easier to vote early and by mail. Then the coronavirus pandemic hit, and voters who wanted to avoid polling places signed up in huge numbers. There are 9 million voters here. 2.5 million of them signed up for mail ballots. For most counties, that meant all of a sudden they were processing 10 times as many mail ballots as before. Philadelphia has more than 1.1 million voters. That's and up to 400,000 of them cast votes by mail. The city spent $5 million and in just a few weeks built this impressive vote-by-mail counting factory at the convention center. But even with this, Philadelphia City Commissioner Al Schmidt, he says processing and counting all those ballots takes time.
Full tilt, we're talking about 10 to 12,000 an hour. But that's uninterrupted, right?
And, of course, it's never uninterrupted. Officials here say it'll take several days to count most of the ballots. Some of them will be coming up, still be coming in through the week because under state law, as long as they're postmarked by election day, they can arrive as late as Friday.
Right. So that's the mail-in ballots. But, I mean, still a lot of people went to the polls on election day, right? What are the latest numbers?
Yeah, they did. And the early numbers in Pennsylvania show Trump winning here. But that really doesn't tell us much. The votes that came in first were from more Republican parts of the state. And officials say many more Democrats chose to vote by mail than Republicans by about a 2-to-1 margin. And since all of those votes are not part of that total yet, the race could tighten here significantly. Or as the polls have shown before the election, Biden may still come out ahead in Pennsylvania.
So what are the conversations you've been having with actual voters? What are they telling you?
Yeah, I was out talking with people before the polls closed, and a few mentioned that they had to wait in line to vote. Heard a few complaints I didn't hear any complaints, actually, about mail-in voting. People love that here now. Certainly, I didn't hear any complaints about results coming in slowly. That may change as the days wear on. But officials here, including Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, have been warning Pennsylvanians that it will take longer than usual to learn who won this time.
I encourage all of us to take a deep breath and be patient. What is most important is that we have accurate results, even if it takes a little longer.
Governor Wolf and Secretary of State Kathy Buchvar have been all over the airwaves here for weeks saying the vote count was going to be slow and asking for patience.
President Trump has raised questions about voting in Philadelphia a number of times on the campaign trail. He said, quote, bad things happen in Philadelphia, sowing all of this distrust in the system. Did you see any of Trump campaign poll watchers that he was sort of telling people to go out and watch themselves?
Yeah, I did. When I took a tour of the mail ballot counting facility, they were sitting in chairs off to the side watching dozens of workers in bright vests counting the ballots. We don't know if they found anything yet, but we know that the campaigns have been preparing for legal battles. We're going to have to wait and see, the cases that have been filed, if anything sticks. But certainly there's more to come here on the legal front.
NPR's Jeff Brady in Philadelphia. You hear him on NPR News.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and about 15 minutes or so before 9 o'clock, we'll have the latest news for you just after 9, and then classical music with Stephanie Elkins. And coming up in 9 minutes, a group that places needy children in foster care does not work with same-sex couples for religious reasons. We'll hear more about a dispute before the Supreme Court that pits religious rights against anti-discrimination laws.
We've been living in this coronavirus economy for more than 7 months now, and we've kind of lost a way of life, which means a lot of us, in one way or another, are doing that thing you do when you lose something.
Going through the stages of grief, in a way. I've been depressed. I have quit one of my jobs.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, living in the corona economy, next time on Marketplace.
Hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/Wisconsin.
Support also comes from Steve's Wine, Beer, and Spirits, locally owned and operated since 1953. Three Madison locations open daily from 11 to 7, with curbside pickup available. More is at stevesknows.com.
It's 8:44 now. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. As votes in the presidential election continue to be counted, we'll report on developments throughout the day here on WPR. And join us tonight at 8 for an NPR election update special with the latest election news from around the country here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can also follow developments, including Wisconsin election results, at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And from Total Wine & More, where in-store teams can recommend a bottle of wine, spirit, or beer for any occasion. Shoppers can explore more than 8,000 wines, 2,500 beers, and 3,000 spirits. More at TotalWine.com.
It's 8:45 now. This is Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a young entrepreneur in Milwaukee who's keeping her lemonade business going well after summer and into the school year.
One of the quintessential summer activities for kids is setting up a lemonade stand. You can find them all over Wisconsin. And one 9-year-old in Milwaukee has taken her lemonade stand to the next level by bottling the drink and donating some of her profits. Kierick's Lemonade has developed a devoted following and is popping up all over social media.
So the flavors are blue, pineapple, regular, pink, and orange.
That's Kierick Burt, owner of Kierick's Lemonade. And here's her mom, Nikki Burt.
I assist with her ordering. I help her with everything it takes to make the lemonade.
Yes.
And what goes into the sweet and tart lemonade?
No tap water and fresh squeezed lemon.
There has to be more.
It's a secret.
Secret. And you're gonna have to buy it.
I have a customer outside.
The day's first customer arrives to pick up her order, curbside and socially distant. Most days, Kierick sells dozens of bottles and gallons online. She's even shipped her lemonade across the country.
They keep coming back to buy from me because they think it's really, really good and they just wanted to support.
Her work ethic is crazy.
Yeah.
Stay up all night. Yeah, she's up all night. She's up early in the morning. Like, she is hands-on with her business because I need her to understand the beginning to the end so that someday I can pull back and then she take care of everything.
Kierick first set up her lemonade stand at church.
Well, we was on a rummage sale, and we wanted to sell lemonade, so we did, and it went off very good, and a lot of people liked this.
And then after that, we did bottles, a gallon for one person. We just posted casually on Facebook, thank you for allowing us to, you know, and it went crazy after that. Crazy.
Nikki says Kierick has treated herself to a new pair of roller skates, and she wants her to start saving for college, but most of the lemonade proceeds go to Kierick's community. She donated gallons of lemonade and hygiene products to homeless veterans in Milwaukee. Kierick also donates to the Wisconsin Humane Society.
Well, I wanted a bunny, and I can't have one. And I really wanted to do something good for, like, the homeless pets. And I just thought it would be nice to give them food.
I tell people all the time, it makes me feel so warm and fuzzy in the inside because she get it. At night, I cry a little bit. Because I'm like, she get it. It's not just about her. It's about her community. And that warms my heart.
Nikki says they're working on taking Keurig's lemonade to the next level. The bottles are currently being sold in one neighborhood convenience store, but they have dreams of grocery stores and bigger markets.
I wish my lemonade would be so famous that I could just walk down a red carpet. Even like I can be on commercials on TV, DJ Khaled or something. Or somebody famous could be in there with me.
And another one. That's the one.
Another one. I love that.
As for advice for future entrepreneurs or current business owners,
just like try to put yourself out there more.
Listen to your children. They will lead you down the path that they desire to go. Do not, I repeat, do not push your own thoughts and your own ideas or your visions on your children.
Keep working on it, and as soon you'll get like me. I'm glad I did a lemonade business because I feel like it just makes me happy. Just selling lemonade with people buying it, seeing them happy, makes me happy.
That was Keurig and Nikki Burt, owners of Keurig's Lemonade in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Jen White, host of 1A. Join me for a conversation with the host of WPR's The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent, on Thursday, November 19th at noon. Register now for this free online event. Get a behind-the-scenes look at running a live daily talk show and our take on the stories we're following. Find out more at WPR.org/presents.
It's Morning Edition on WPR.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
Tennessee says she went into the voting booth undecided. She thought about the Second Amendment, the economy, and the dignity of the office.
Well, I came to the conclusion that I couldn't vote for any of the options, so I just did a write-in. I was always a solid conservative up until 2016. I sort of held my nose and voted for Trump. But this year, I just couldn't do it.
In Brooklyn, New York, Catherine Kattari cast her vote for the president in person.
I pray to God Trump does not concede. And say if the country has to go to a civil war, the people in this country are ready to fight for their country.
Joseph Fernandez of Redwood City, California, voted by mail for Joe Biden.
I would hope the American people would want to focus more on how we can agree and find a consensus on the things that we feel most strongly about.
Jackie Varner took our call from a Republican watch party in Duval County, Florida. She was happy to see Trump take the state and wants the country to unite around the economy.
I think we come together with this COVID mess. We get through this. I want the economy to stay open, and I want us to continue on with our lives.
Colorado went for Democrats partly due to voters like Alex Leith in Denver, who was unaffiliated and chose Biden after the conventions.
We need to continue to have this discussion that we've kind of been yelling at each other for the last 4 years. And we need to do it calmly without any finger pointing.
Some of the voices of voters around this country.
Elections come and go, but Supreme Court decisions can last forever. One of those potentially pivotal cases is before the court today. It's a case that pits anti-discrimination laws against religious rights. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
There really are no bad guys in this story. The city of Philadelphia has protective custody of about 5,000 children who've been abused or neglected. The city contracts with private agencies to care for these children in group homes and for the certification, placement, and care of children in individual foster care homes. Among the 30 private agencies that do this work is Catholic Social Services, affiliated with the Catholic Archdiocese, which has contracted with the city for these services for over 50 years. But in 2018, the Philadelphia Inquirer disclosed that Catholic Social Services did not certify and place children in the homes of married same-sex couples. Ultimately, the city stopped placing children in individual homes through CSS. CSS sued, contending that by cutting off its future placements, the city was denying CSS and its families the free exercise of their religious rights. Two lower courts ruled in favor of the city, and CSS appealed to the Supreme Court, which will hear arguments in the case today. Joining the suit are two foster parents, both single mothers, both African American and Catholic. Sharon L. Fulton has fostered 40 children over 25 years.
The biggest thrill that I get is when they all sleep and I can walk through and look in their little faces and check their dirty hands. And I say, yeah, I got this. This is what I want to do. And I wouldn't be able to do it without Catholic Social Services.
Tony Sims Bush, a child advocate in Philadelphia, has fostered 5 children, adopting the last 2, brothers who are now 2 and 4.
It is taking away my right as a religious person that I can't foster or adopt through an agency who has a shared belief.
There are, of course, other wonderful foster parents who are not affiliated with CSS. Among them are same-sex married couples like Lou Gromiller and his husband Michael, who fostered children over 10 years, adopting the last 2, a girl now 9 and a boy now almost 7. Lou, a social worker, sees the CSS refusal to work with gay couples as making no sense when the need for foster parents is so great.
Why would that be a reason to deny people to be a temporary safe haven to children, vulnerable children and kids who need it? I guess my question is, who's next? If I was not a Catholic or a Christian, would they turn me down?
The legal questions before the Supreme Court today are basically 2. First is whether Philadelphia's decision not to renew some of its contracts with CSS are within the city's rights. Lawyer Lori Windham of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty will tell the Supreme Court today that the city, by canceling the contract for future placements, is violating the Constitution's guarantee for the free exercise of religion.
At bottom, this is about the city of Philadelphia trying to exclude Catholic Social Services from work it's been doing for 2 centuries.
Nothing could be further from the truth.
Lawyer Neil Katyal will be representing the city of Philadelphia.
We adore CSS. We've been partners with them for years and years. And indeed, right now, we're giving them over $17 million a year in contracts for congregate foster care.
That's group care homes run by CSS, where there's no discrimination question at all. The city also continues to support those children already placed by CSS in private foster care homes, but it has not renewed the contract for future home foster care placements because, as the city sees it, CSS has violated the terms of its contract. Again, lawyer Katya.
You can't on Monday sign a contract that says we won't discriminate, and on Tuesday go ahead and discriminate.
CSS counters that it would be happy to refer same-sex couples to other agencies, and there are 29 others operating in Philadelphia. Until now, at least, the Supreme Court has viewed government as acting at the height of its powers when it contracts with a private entity for services. In 1990, the Supreme Court ruled that when a neutral law is enforced in a generally applicable way, it is presumptively legitimate, even if it has an incidental adverse impact on some group of citizens. The author of that opinion was the late Justice Antonin Scalia, a conservative icon and devout Catholic. Now, Catholic Social Services is asking the Supreme Court to reverse that decision because it sees the non-discrimination provision in the city contract as forcing CSS to endorse same-sex marriage in violation of their faith. Several of the Supreme Court's most conservative justices have urged revisiting Scalia's decision, and the court's newest justice, Amy Coney Barrett, served on the board of her children's religious school, which, according to the Associated Press, did not admit children of same-sex couples. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
This is WPR, and we'll continue to bring you election results throughout the day. And there's lots more to read and listen to on our website at WPR.org. In addition, NPR will have a special update on the election tonight at 8 p.m. WPR will be carrying that coverage again starting at 8.
Support for WPR comes from Sitka Salmon Shares, a community-supported fishery home delivering seasonal shares of wild Alaskan seafood. Online ordering at sitkasalmonshares.com/WPR.
Support also comes from Metcalf's Market, a family-owned Wisconsin grocery offering fully prepared Thanksgiving dinners fresh from Metcalf's kitchens this holiday season. Complete menu and ordering details are at shopmetcalfs.com.